You would never forget about it at all.
It is.
So it is a tremendous experience. Inshallah, you would have and you would pray for us. I wish plenty and abundance of beautiful days to come for every single creature who is actually listening to us. All the youngsters, I wish them at least they try this experience for once, because it is going to be such a remarkable experience in their lives. Every moment is a new chance to turn it all around. So thank you, dear listeners. Until another session of Tutu Kachu, Youth Station, I bid you farewell.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at stories through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll take a look at trending news, and this week we're looking at historical stories which have a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. Today, we're going to celebrate one of the golden ages of Islamic history, the 800-year period the Muslims ruled over what is modern-day Spain and Portugal. The anniversary of the end of that glorious period falls in the month of January, which is a great opportunity for Muslims to reflect on what made Muslim Spain or Al-Andalus so great.
In January 1492, the last Muslim kingdom of Al-Andalus, better known as Muslim Spain, fell to the Catholic monarchs, putting an end to 800 years of glorious Islamic civilization. The Muslim presence in the Iberian Peninsula was a time when religious tolerance, sophisticated scholarship, glorious architecture, and a superior lifestyle prevailed. Muslim Spain is now best known by the glories of its architecture, such as the Alhambra Palace in Granada, one of Europe's most visited monuments. But it was perhaps the Cordoba Caliphate from the 8th to 11th centuries which personified Al-Andalus at its height, with Muslims, Jews, and Christians all intermingling and flourishing under Muslim rule. By the 15th century, the Christians had begun to squeeze the Muslims. But the real impetus for the fall of Granada was when Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile married to unite the two largest Christian kingdoms. These monarchs had a vision of a uniquely Catholic nation. Around 100,000 Muslims were subsequently killed or enslaved, and 200,000 fled. Later, a decree would be ordered, forcing those who remained to convert to Christianity on pain of death. The Catholic monarchs also passed a decree expelling all Jews or forcing them to convert, again on pain of death.
Well, later on in the show, we'll be talking to two experts on Islamic Spain. But first, joining us in the studio today is Roshan Mohamed Saleh, who is the editor of the Muslim news website Five Pillars. Roshan is a very frequent visitor to the historic Muslim areas of modern-day Spain and has kindly agreed to share his experiences with us today. Roshan, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on, as always. Just tell me, what's your view of Islamic Spain? Tell me about your experiences there.
Well, I've been there about 10 times over the years, and the last time was only about a month and a half ago. And I just think it's the most beautiful part of Europe, I think. And especially if you're a Muslim and you're interested in Islamic history, like every Muslim should be, then Andalusia in the southern part of Spain, where the Muslim influence is the strongest, is the place to go. And I could recommend a few places, like Granada is the obvious place with the Alhambra Palace, which is probably the most beautiful monument in Europe. It's just an amazing place, a fortress and several palaces. Then there's the Mesquita or the mosque, the Grand Mosque of Cordoba, which is literally one of the most beautiful mosques in the whole world. And even Masjid al-Nabawi in Medina, it's modelled on the Mezquita in Cordoba, the famous arches. And there are other, you know, beautiful places like there's a fortress in Malaga, there's a Muslim tower in Seville. So it's literally, and the landscape will remind lots of Muslims of North Africa as well, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, you know, mountainous olive trees everywhere. It's just a really beautiful place.
No, I'm pretty embarrassed to say I haven't been yet, unfortunately.
Okay,
I must go. But interesting enough, you've written about the sadness you feel when you visit this region as well. Could you explain that to me?
Yeah, so it's kind of, I always have mixed feelings. I'm really happy to be there. But when you visit some of these Muslim monuments, you know, they've been desecrated by the Christians. After the fall of Granada in 1492, the Catholic monarchs in particular, they had this policy of desecrating Qurans and just generally denigrating Muslim culture. So
forced
the Alhambra...
Forced conversions.
Yeah, exactly. And the Alhambra, for example, they built a kind of a palace, a Christian-style palace right in the middle of the Alhambra, which looks really incongruous next to the Muslim architecture. They did the same thing in the Grand Mosque of Cordoba. They put a Christian cathedral right in the middle of that mosque. So they basically vandalized it. And, you know, when you go to these places, you can't pray, for example. If you try to pray as a Muslim, even though there's a mihrab there, you know, direction of the prayer, you know, you're ready to pray, but they won't let you pray. They'll physically stop you from praying. You could get arrested if you pray. So it's just a reminder of what we lost. And the fact is that we're not allowed to celebrate it properly in modern day Muslim Spain.
Yes, it's interesting you mention those points because there surely are some Muslims still left in Spain. What's the community like there?
Limited. There's a bit of immigration, kind of like, you know, menial labour from places like Morocco especially, but, you know, Tunisia and other places in North Africa and, you know, sub-Saharan Africa as well. But the Muslim presence in Spain is less than it would be in other European countries like the UK, for example, where we have 4 million plus Muslims, France, where there's 6 million plus Muslims. It's much less. I think it's well under a million in Spain. And that's because there's been a deliberate policy of, you know, kind of keeping the Muslim presence in Spain quite small. Mosques, for example, regularly are denied building permits. There are a few mosques now, but there aren't many mosques. But still, you can see the vestiges of Muslim Spain, even the faces of the people, because lots of Spaniards, Christian Spaniards, were originally Arabs, and they have Arab blood in them. Even the Spanish language has lots of Arabic words. The food, and it permeates every aspect of life, but sometimes you have to look for it.
Yes, and I know that there are still place names which originate from the Arabic language.
Absolutely.
That haven't changed, that type of thing. And I wonder, very briefly, Roshan, Islamophobia is a European-wide phenomena, it's a problem across the board. But in Spain, would you say that it's worse because of this issue? They're trying to stamp out Muslim culture?
Absolutely. They were doing that because, you know, the policy once 1492 happened, it was eradication of Islam. And that has served as a blueprint for modern societies. France is going down that route in many ways, not physical extermination, but extermination of a religion, and lots of European societies. So even the influence of, you know, the Spanish Inquisition, for example, you know, it permeates into modern life even today.
Well, Roshan, we are going to come back to you later on in the show, if I'm not mistaken. But for the time being, I want to move on and take a look at what people on social media have been saying about the anniversary of Al-Andalus and its fall in modern-day Spain.
Twitter has become awash with opinions regarding the legacy of Islamic Spain. Muslims hold Al-Andalus in high regard and praised the period as a shining example of an Islamic region leading in tolerance and enlightenment.
One of the most understudied pieces of human history, the impact this caliphate had on knowledge building alone is tremendous to today's modern society. May this serve as a reminder for all, regardless of religion or culture, to appreciate Muslim contributions to history. Alhamdulillah, since its arrival, Islam has still been there longer than it hasn't. May bring back the Nur that illuminated Europe, and by extension, the world. Ameen.
Some non-Muslims used the occasion to troll Muslims and praise the collapse of Islamic rule in the Iberian Peninsula.
People of Spain are so happy they drove the invaders back to where they belonged. Spain grew to be a great nation and an empire. They helped greatly to push back the Ottomans, and keep them away from total defeat of Europe.
While other Muslims believe lessons should be learned about Muslims and their trust for the un-Islamic world.
It's what happens when you sit on your laurels and you're not alerted to the plots of the disbelievers. You have to never trust the disbelievers and must be permanently on high alert to defend yourself and spread your cause. Today again, we are trusting them whilst they plot our destruction. Many of the traits for which modern US prides itself comes from Muslim Spain, who achieved these traits first. Diplomacy, free trade, open borders, techniques of academic research, anthropology, fashion, algorithms, medicine, hospitals, etc. But the only thing the West associates us with is terrorism.
Well, I'm honoured to declare that we have another guest joining us now to add to this discussion, Dr. Uthman Latif, a celebrated Muslim author, a renowned historian, teacher and lecturer based here in Britain. Assalamu alaikum, Doctor. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. Now, firstly, just start off by telling us why you think Islamic Spain was so great in your view.
I think for a few reasons. One, because Spain is recognised as Al-Andalus. In fact, that period is called by historians as the convivencia, as the coexistence between Muslims, Jews and Christians, an unparalleled kind of moment in human history where Jews, Christians and Muslims could thrive under Islamic rule in Islamic Spain. So we have, of course, a great kind of legacy of achievement under great rulers like Abdurrahman III, Al-Hakam II, the building of schools, of universities, of hospitals, of mosques, of maktab, of all of these things. But I think that period, in fact, is very unique in human history because it represents kind of like you might call a golden age of civilization in Islam, but also, in fact, in Judaism. It's also seen as a golden age of Judaism. So, even for Christians, it's seen as a very great moment in their history.
Now, one of the aspects praised by both Muslim and even non-Muslim historians as well was the overall theme of tolerance, particularly towards religious minorities under Muslim rule, like Jews, for example, and the Christians too. But was it really as harmonious as it's made out by some?
Well, society, in fact, is in constant flux. There's never going to be a totality of anything. You're going to find good moments and also difficult moments as well. But remember, of course, when the Muslims arrived in 711, the Jews were facing a lot of persecution from the Catholic Christians. You had the Fourth Council of Toledo, and Jews were forced into baptism, forced conversions, expulsion from the land. And Zion Zohar, a Jewish academic, says that when the Muslims cross the Straits of Gibraltar, they welcome Muslims as liberators from Christian persecution. And that's kind of a standard narrative, and in fact, not just to do with Spain, but also in Jerusalem and also elsewhere as well. The Maghreb after the Inquisition as well, that Muslims have always been kind of seen as champions of justice, you know, for other people. So therefore, Spain kind of, I think, is representative of that.
Now, during this period, Europe is often referred to as going through a dark age in its history. Muslim Spain, of course, was going through a period of enlightenment. What kind of role did Muslim Spain have on dark age Europe?
We have a kind of a juxtaposition, in fact, in historical terms and cultural social terms, because what the Muslims are doing, in fact, in Spain at that time of that darkness in European history is enlightening the world. We have the beginning, in fact, of the seeds of the Renaissance of Western Europe. Because Spain, of course, is in Europe. And we have, like I mentioned, the thriving of the culture of arts, of science, of botany. Seville, in fact, was known as a center of botany. Abu Bakr al-Ubaidi, Ibn al-Awwam al-Ishbili, very famous names, al-Ghafiqi, Ibn al-Baytar, Ibn Zuhr, Ibn Zawar, you know, very famous names, people excelling, in fact, in sciences, in geology, in geography, in mathematics, in astronomy. And then, of course, you have the beginning of taking these knowledges back to Europe, like from people like Petrus Alfonsi, for example, Michael Scott, who learned with the Muslims in Al-Andalus, in the schools of Toledo of Cordoba, and then took that knowledge back to Western Europe and began to educate the Europeans and their nobility about what the Muslims are learning, in fact, of these great sciences. And then, of course, they took it back, they enhanced it. That became the beginning of their renaissance in Western Europe.
Now, Doctor, final question. What can we, the Muslim Ummah, learn? What lessons can we take from this period in Islamic history?
Well, I think one of the interesting things is you have this Imam Ar-Rundi writes a poem after the fall of Seville, 1248, I think it was. And it begins his poem by saying, لِكُلِّ شَيْنِ ذَاتْ مَا تَمَا نُقْصَانْ فَلَا تَغُرُّ بِالطَّيْبِ الْعَيْشِ يَا إِنسَانْ فأين الملوك ذو التيجان من يمن وأين ما حزوا قارون من ذهب وأين عاد وثمود. He's asking like, is everything that reaches its apex, its pinnacle, will have a defect and a fault. Nothing is, the dunya, the world we live in, isn't supposed to be back to be perfect. And he says that where are the kingdoms of Ad and Thamud? Where is Qarun and his treasures? Where is Qurtuba? He says upon all of them came an affair. فَكَأَنَّ الْقَوْمَ مَا كَنُوا. And it's as if, death came to all of them, and it's as if they didn't exist there in the first place. And that's a lesson, in fact. Every rule is temporal, is limited by vulnerability, by time. And so no one holds the keys of power forever. It's a lesson, in fact. I was in one of the trips I had to Spain. We visited the other city that was built outside Córdoba called the Medina of Zahra, built up. It was named after the wife, I think, of Abd al-Rahman III. And 10% of it is excavated in the land from 1910 onward. That was the most glorious city. In fact, his diplomat was Jewish, Shasta ibn Shafud, and he would invite other kings and nobles to London to see the splendor of Islamic Spain. But the city is simply a loss, is a sign for us. And so I think that you look at two or three fundamental things. One, of course, is that having too much of the world isn't always a good thing, the dunya. And they had too much of the world. And all these examples in the Quran about the positive and negative kingdoms, like, for example, Suleiman was a good king, Dhul Qarnayn, a good king, but Qarun and Fir'aun were bad kings. And about the way that they appreciate and approach temporal power. The second thing, of course, is the difficulty of division. Once you divide, you become weak. Allah in the Quran, of course, is reminding the people, don't differ and argue, because when you're hard, and that's weakness. And that's what happened. So dunya, one thing, vision, of course, is the other thing. And both of these, I think, affected the Muslims of Al-Andalus.
Unfortunately, Doctor, I have to end our discussion there for the time being. But thank you very much. We did appear to have some signal issues towards the end, but you passed on your points very, very well. And I think we learned a lot from that discussion. Well, earlier on, we also spoke to Muslim historian Asim Akil, who's also known as Tariq Trekker on YouTube. Tariq Trekker has filmed and presented an online history of Al-Andalus, which is available for all to see on his YouTube channel. We spoke about what happened to Muslim Spain after its tragic end.
I think the phenomenon of Islamic Spain known as Al-Andalus is great for many reasons. Number one, it can represent kind of like a lost paradise. It was a place where, or the first place in Europe where three religions lived together in peace for centuries, way before what we have in Europe today. I can remember listening to one historian on the topic say that the three religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the people of these religions all had the same culture, which when you think about it, is very different to what we see today in the Western world. So it was very unique. Spain is a modern day conception which comes into being after 1492. Prior to that, it was the Iberian Peninsula with a whole mix of ethnicities who would come in, whether it be Goths or Vandals or Greeks or Latin people, and eventually Berbers and Arabs. And the idea that it was a conquest, you can argue that it was a conquest. There are certain narratives as well that the Muslims were actually invited in by Count Julian, a Christian ruler from Ceuta, which is in North Africa. I think the time period of the Reconquista narrative finishes in 1492. That's when the reconquest is complete. The Jewish people, unfortunately, didn't flee. They were actually thrown out. The Muslims had a bit of a leeway for a bit longer, maybe for about another 120 years, but their life was made very difficult. Under the terms of the capitulations, the Treaty of Granada, the ruler, Muhammad XII, agreed to transfer power to to Ferdinand and Isabella on the premise that the Muslim population could keep their religion, keep their properties, and keep their wealth. Within 10 years, there'd been a lot of aggravation by the Catholic authorities to the Muslims in the Granada region, so they rebelled. Ferdinand and Isabella claimed that this rebellion was in violation of the Treaty of Granada, so they did not have to show any more religious tolerance towards the Muslims. So they were then ordered to force to convert to Catholicism en masse, which the vast majority of people did. They kept Islam in their hearts, and they practiced Islam in secret in their houses, and outwardly, in public, they appeared as Christian. But the authorities were aware of what was going on, and slowly but surely they started clamping down. So they started banning all Arabic books, burning the Quran, banning Arabic dress, banning Arabic customs, asking people to keep their doors open, their houses on Friday, so they could come in and see what you were doing, and on days which would have been Eid as well. And as the decades went on, towards the end of the 1560s and the 1570s, the way which these rules were enforced became a lot more stricter, until eventually Muslims decided to go all out rebellion. We're going to declare our Islam openly, and we're going to fight for our existence. This was brutally put down, and eventually the order came in the early 1600s that all Moriscos, and a Morisco is a Spanish word which means little more, a person who used to be Muslim, probably still is a Muslim, but Christian outwardly, has to be expelled from the Iberian Peninsula. So by 1613, remaining Muslims were on the coast, ready to get ships to North Africa.
So a sad and brutal end to Islamic Spain there. But let's head back to my guest in the studio, Roshan Mohammed Saleh, for more on this. So, Roshan, of course, we've learned a lot today about Islamic Spain, and there's many positives that we take from that period, and potentially some not so many positives as well, as we saw from the brutal way it ended. But tell me, do you think that Al-Andalus could serve as a model for a future Islamic society?
I think it's certainly a model for Muslims in Europe because of the nature of the... I mean, it was a Muslim society. It was Muslim ruled. Muslims were in charge. It was God-centred, but at the same time, minorities thrived. Christians and Jews especially thrived within that society. And I think, given that in Europe and even parts of the Muslim world, we have countries which may be Muslim majority, but there are lots of minorities there as well of other religions, it does serve as a model. It serves as a model of, you know, kind of, it's a reminder of what we could achieve when we were at our best. And I do believe wholeheartedly it can be implemented today as well. And the other thing I wanted to say is that I think this whole show has been a reminder for us that Muslims, we must study our glorious Islamic history. I mean, there were several golden ages. I guess Sunnis would say the Rashidun period was the golden age. I know Shias might have a different conception of that. Then there was the golden age under the Abbasids in Baghdad. And I think the third and perhaps the last golden age of Islamic history was Muslim Spain. The Ottomans may disagree with that, you know, but there's arguments to and fro. But I think, you know, it serves as a real iman booster for Muslims to study our history. And it wasn't all a bed of roses. We had bad kings and good kings, good rulers, bad rulers, good periods and bad periods. You know, history is human, and Islamic history is human as well. But what I always say is the bad bits come from the humans, the good bits come from Islam.
Do you think that that's a problem, though, Roshan, that perhaps we're over-glorifying these periods when, of course, you know, like you say, they weren't perfect, they weren't a utopian society?
I think we should study Islamic history in depth, not just Muslim Spain, but the Ottoman period, the Arab period, all the different periods, even Muslims as minorities in the West. And we'll find good and bad. But I sincerely believe that the good far outweighs the bad. But we shouldn't sugarcoat our history as well. We don't have to defend every aspect of history in Muslim countries, like slavery, for example. There's a lot of bad stuff that went on there. But that's not from Islam. It's from flawed human beings. And the final thing I want to say is that, you know, may the light of Islam shine in the Iberian Peninsula, in modern-day Spain and Portugal, yet again today.
Inshallah. Well, that might be an interesting question to end the show on as well. What should we be doing? Because, as you say, you're not allowed to go there and pray, for example. There's a bit of desecration going on. Like, I don't know, should Muslims do more about this? Should there be some kind of effort done to try and change the Spanish authorities' view on this? What do you think?
I think we need to raise awareness about, you know, how we're treated. I mean, I went to the mosque in Cordoba just about a month and a half ago. I did a little video saying, you know, the Christians have desecrated this place. Mm. And this is what we've lost. It's a reminder of what we've lost.
Do you think we should just go there and start praying regardless?
Well, people have done that. I mean, you'll get arrested. So, you know, I'm not encouraging people to get arrested, but Muslims have done that and they have been arrested. Mm. And some of them, I think, been threatened with deportation or prison or something like that. Wow. I don't think anyone has been jailed, but, ridiculous. You know, they don't allow, they have security guards running around. I just think we have to raise awareness. And of course, as Muslims, we have to give dawah, we have to invite the Spanish non-Muslims to Islam. This is what we have to do, you know, as Muslims, it's part of our duty.
It's fascinating how the emphasis is on pointing the finger at how Islam behaves and how Muslims behave, apparently spreading by the sword, when in fact we see here with the Reconquista that actually Christianity was spread by the sword in this regard. Thank you, Roshan. We have to end it there. We could talk a lot more on this. That is unfortunately all the time we have for today. But thank you to all of our guests and for you at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The war in Ukraine has created huge political, economic and security losses for Europe, and the energy crisis caused by the Russian oil and gas embargo can be considered the most immediate and main impact of the war in Ukraine on Europe's economy. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Britain's Financial Times newspaper has covered this story and tells us more. Economists warn the lingering energy crisis is expected to cause further recession in the Eurozone this year. According to the latest report, prices in the region will rise by an average of over 6%, while the unemployment rate will increase from the current 6.5% to 7.1% by the end of 2023. High inflation and energy shortages will lead to a further decline in production and worsen the situation in the labour market. Subsequently, by the end of the year, the Eurozone economy will shrink by 0.01%. The energy crisis in the European Union worsened over the summer when sanctions and technical setbacks led to the first interruptions in gas supplies from Russia. While most economists have said that Europe is past the worst of the energy crisis this year, many worry that the prospect of energy rationing would return next heating season, especially if the upcoming months are cold and cause increased tapping of gas reserves. Economists are also worried about the outcome of further steps to stem inflation by the European Central Bank, the ECB. Marcelo Missori, an economics professor at Lewis University in Rome, Italy, warned that further interest rate hikes could lead to a severe recession in the euro area. Agence France-Presse has also covered the same story and tells us more. Official figures showed recently inflation in Sweden surged to its highest point in the past three decades in December, fueled by soaring electricity prices that have hit the cost of living. Statistics Sweden said the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, accelerated to 12.3%, up from 11.5% in November, the highest figure since February of 1991. The main driver was the price of electricity, which rose 28.8% in December compared to the month before, and 45.3% compared to a year earlier. Sweden's inflation rate adjusted for fixed interest rates, the figure used by Sweden's central bank to guide monetary policy, jumped to 10.2% on an annual basis, up from 9.5% in November. In a bid to counter soaring inflation, the Scandinavian country's central bank has sharply hiked its key interest rate in recent months, from 0 in April to 2.5% currently, with its next monetary policy meeting scheduled for early February. The bank has signalled that more increases are underway. Inflation has soared worldwide in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, which started in February of 2022, prompting central banks to hike interest rates. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to official data released recently, Hungary's annual inflation rate spiked to 24.5% in December, the highest level since March of 1996. The Hungarian Central Statistical Office said electricity, gas and other fuels, along with food prices, were the main drivers of high inflation in Hungary. Electricity, gas and other fuels were 55.5% more expensive in December. Food prices jumped 44.8% on an annual basis, consumer durables jumped 13.6%, and service charges were up 9.5%. The authority said consumer prices increased by 1.9% on average in 1 month and by 14.5% on average in 2022, compared to the previous year. China's Xinhua news agency has also covered the same story. Portugal's National Institute of Statistics announced the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, registered an average annual variation of 7.8% in 2022 in the country, the highest since 1992. Last year, the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, rose 6.5 percentage points compared to 2021, when it was 1.3%. Rising energy and food prices were the main elements contributing to the increase in the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. Portuguese inflation rose more intensely in the first half of last year, while prices slowed down in the last 2 months of 2022. According to China's Xinhua news agency, Statistics Netherlands said on Tuesday, 10th of January, the annual inflation rate in the Netherlands was 10% in 2022, the highest since 1975, when the rate was 10.2% as a result of the oil crisis. Last year, the price development of energy, such as electricity, gas and district heating, in particular contributed to the high rate. The energy was on average 114% more expensive in 2022 than in 2021. The inflation rate was 2.7% in 2021. Food and motor fuels also had an impact on inflation. Food was 10.8% more expensive than 12 months previously. In 2021, food prices were still 0.2% lower. The rise in food prices was mainly caused by meat, dairy products, bread and grains and vegetables. In 2022, Motor fuels were 18.1% more expensive than the year before, while in 2021, the increase was 16.8%. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, said on Tuesday, 10th of January, Greece's economic growth is likely to show just 1.1% this year from a 5.1% clip in 2022, as soaring energy costs and continued uncertainty about the war in Ukraine hurt spending and investments. Since the lifting of COVID restrictions, the Greek economy has recovered strongly thanks to the robust tourism revenues and improving consumer spending and investments. However, surging energy costs, supply disruptions and uncertainty, mainly because of the war in Ukraine, are sharply slowing down the recovery in Greece. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, said, the war is directly affecting Greece's energy supply and costs. Its indirect effects are compressing spending and delaying investment and hiring. Inflation, driven by rising energy prices, hit a 30-year high of 12% last summer in Greece and is eating away at Greek households' income. Britain's Guardian newspaper has also covered the same story. The Italian government statistics office reported recently prices in Italy rose 8.1% year-on-year in 2022, with surging energy prices contributing the most to what was the largest full-year increase since the mid-1980s. The full-year rate was the highest recorded in Italy since a 9.2% annual increase in 1985, when Italy still used the lira currency. In December, prices were 11.6% higher than in the same month in 2021 and down from 11.8% in November. It was still the third highest one-month rate recorded since the introduction of the euro currency in 1999. According to the National Institute of Statistics, the seven highest monthly inflation rates recorded in Italy since 1999 have all been in the last 7 months. High energy prices have been responsible for the bulk of these increases, pushed higher by the energy supply challenges caused by the conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. It takes courage to grow up and become who you really are. However, this growth and upbringing has a major play by parents. And in this program, we try to guide the parents how to take the proper steps to upbring their children in, under the umbrella of Islam. And the answers to your questions, issues are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Dear listeners, Professor Nakavi is a researcher in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom and also a faculty member at Al Mustafa University. So one of the parts of the environment you said is a virtual world. Now a teenager is put in front of a virtual world, and as you said in previous episode, it's becoming very, very dangerous. Now, how do parents help their teenagers to control over this virtual tech, virtual environment that they are in relation with?
Actually, we need to start from the natural world, the natural world.
Okay.
There, as you mentioned, that we need to somehow engage ourselves and our family and our children and make them go out into the natural world. I mean, there's so much beauty out there. Unfortunately, because we have not been, especially in the lives which we have in the cities today, the mechanical life, so fast moving life, everything is moving so fast, you cannot control things. We cannot give time. We do not give time to ourselves, to our children. As Allah Almighty says, as the Imams have said, that divide your lives into three or four parts.
Yeah.
One of them should be for recreation, for refreshment, for enjoying.
Your leisure time.
Leisure time, so that you can benefit from that and get energized for carrying out your duties in the other two or three parts of your lives, daily lives. So we're not doing that. We're not engaging with our family. We're not engaging with our children. We're not taking them into the environment.
Real environment.
I mean, I remember in our school days, school times, school would take us out into the parks, into the forests. We would collect things. We would collect mushrooms. We would collect stones. We would collect pebbles.
Sticks, anything.
Anything. I mean, it was
fun.
A recreation, fun. And then we would be asked to draw them and... Now everything is, look at the computer, find things there and...
Start drawing.
So this is a problem. The connection between the natural world is being disconnected. And beyond that, the connection with the supernatural world is being disconnected. That is the most difficult thing. Now, even if we are to replace the natural world with the virtual world or the physical world, as I again stress, this virtual world is physical.
Yes,
we should not mix it up with the supernatural or something which is beyond that.
Okay.
Virtual reality is a physical reality.
Okay, so virtual world is also a real world.
But again, the same roots have to be taken. I mean, we have to take ourselves back to the roots, that this is also a manifestation of Allah's knowledge and power.
Yeah.
Not only the heavens and the skies and everything which is out there in the celestial bodies or within the human being and his soul, even the creation of the internet, of the virtual environment, is
As we said in last episode, even the ant, even a small ant, you can see so many things.
Like, exactly.
My son was scared when he got into the gallery and saw the pictures, zoomed in pictures of an ant, and he saw, what are you doing with your mobile? And why are you taking pictures of ants? And I was telling him, I just want to go closer to Allah. I just want to know him. And then he started asking questions. How can an ant take you back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? And then I started explaining for him that this small, very minute creature, I want to zoom in, I want to see the structure, and I am amazed to see this organization and just this very horrific, terrible face of an ant, and you get just terrified. But still, the same ant is not making any danger to you. It's not dangerous for you. It's not making any, it's not making any harm for you. We'll discuss more on the topic with you, Professor Nakavi, after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I'm with Professor Nekavi, and we are discussing the virtual world and a teenager's relationship with it. Well, Professor Nekavi, today you said that virtual world is not in the control of the right hands, and anything gets popped in, and you got to be very careful about your teenager. Do you think monitoring things on virtual world is also very essential while your teen is busy on the internet or the social media stuff? You got to monitor things.
Yes, we need to monitor them, but of course the immunization should take place from within. We should create immunity within him, within his thoughts and feelings. And
so even if you're not there, he should be able to...
Yes, he should be able to manage his thoughts and feelings properly. That is what we should teach to him or her. The problem is that whatever safeguards which we can provide, even the companies which are selling these products, they give you ways and means how to control, how to limit or whatever. But today the children are so fast in learning these things, they even outpace us. We can never manage them.
They do.
They are so fast in learning these things. They, whatever lock you make or whatever controls you put in, they, if they want to, they can break them.
So all goes back to want.
Exactly.
So how do we manage that want and need in them?
So it starts from, again, going back to the basics, ourselves, how we manage our thoughts and our feelings, how we develop that mindset, how do we develop that ideology, what worldview are we giving them. If our lives as parents is completely, our lives are engrossed completely in material gains and material benefits, and we're all the time talking about how to make money and how to make personal gains, then certainly our children will be doing the same thing. The most important thing is what we're doing and how we are creating that linkage with the supernatural world. Supernatural means not something which is magical or the occult. It's something very natural in the sense that it is something which is before us.
Okay.
Allah Almighty is before us. We are before Him. This mindset has to be created. The love of Allah has to be created. In each and every manifestation of Allah, we have to remind ourselves and praise Allah Almighty. We drink, we should praise Him. We eat, we should praise Him. We start clothing ourselves, we should recite Bismillah. We start bathing ourselves, we recite Bismillah. I mean, this Bismillah is verbal, but it is enforcing that feeling within us. So it starts from us, it starts from the education and upbringing which we are giving to our children, and developing our own understanding of the world and trying to infuse that into our children is important. Today, even when we talk about science and technology, we're talking about the applications, we lag much behind in the development of the software or applications which we can give our children and provide them as alternatives. I mean, today there's no alternative to a beautiful film or a cartoon which is talking about some story. It's so attractive. It captures your mind. You cannot replace that with just teaching them dry and subjects of Islam and Islamic teachings. You have to develop things through which we can infuse those mindset.
We should have a better alternative. We'll discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I'm with Professor Nekavi, and we are saying that your children, your teenagers, got to be connected to alternatives when they are encountering wrong things on virtual world.
So one of the ways is to develop habits and hobbies which are connected with the natural world. For example, collection of items which are there in nature, handicrafts, making. I remember we used to, for example, go for swimming. We used to go for example, even canoeing or going into boats, making boats, trying to make things from the natural world. I mean, there are so many things which can be done.
Yeah, you have talked of some very beautiful alternatives that you have went through in your childhood and today they are lacking. I would like to ask more. Professor Nakavi, what is it that existed in your childhood and that was a better thing, that was a better alternative, which is absent in today's child's age?
I remember when we used to visit many places with our places of natural history, places, museums of natural history, museums.
Monuments.
Monuments. Go into the past history with our parents. They would take us.
Historical places, museums.
Yeah, we need to develop an attachment with our culture, with our environment, with our history. Today, our children are completely detached from their history, from their background, from whether we are living in our own homelands or we are living as expatriates in other places. We are completely disconnected from our backgrounds, from our history. I mean, when we used to visit places of historical importance, we would be awed by the environment of the past, or we would go to places where we look into the future. So I mean, there's so much to do, but unfortunately, this world is not up today.
Allowing us. So you're trying to say that although virtual world provides us much, much, much information, but our child, our teenager, is not authorized to be CPU of an information. He has to see those informative things in person. He has to get out into the environment. He has to visit the historical monuments, the places, and different things in person, physically, rather than just gathering on information about them.
Technology will help us.
Yeah.
And it will provide us guidance. For example, let me give you an example of my grandson. There's a sky map. There's an application, a sky map. It shows you all the stars.
Wow.
Now, if you look at that, that's wonderful. It's very comprehensive. But I need to take my grandson out and look. You saw that in the application?
No, come out with me at night.
Find it at night. So this is important, the combination between technology.
So both have to go hand in hand.
Technology cannot be removed, cannot be restricted. It has to be channelized in the proper way and managed in the proper way. So it doesn't give us the negatives which are attached to it. We can't do much about that. Till there's a complete change in the mindset of mankind. Today, we have the dark web, the very dangerous form of the web, which is called the dark web. Now, God forbid, if our children get into that, that is a very dangerous place. Narcotics and pornography and so many things which one should be ashamed of.
Yeah.
But that is a...
They're just coming in, popping in.
And there, it's there. We need to defend ourselves. We need to inoculate our children.
Yeah.
So we need to...
So you're saying that more than monitoring your child, you got to develop an insight within him that he himself stays away from all these things, even if they are just popping in, even if he's watching everything is in his excess without you. Thank you so much, Professor Nakavi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know Islam says, it says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.